The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And I'm just going to mute people just so that we have a background noise is not too bad, but don't take it personally, please. But you can always unmute yourself and you can raise your hand or those types of things. So we'd like to begin just with a general check-in. We sent some homework, and if you had a chance to look at it, and Bows, Kim, thank you for doing that. I appreciate that you're sending that. It was beautifully done with nice links that we could just go look at. Manjama 63, Malunkya Buddha, asking the Buddha all these questions. And then these short little suttas where these nuns encounter Mara. And maybe I'll editorialize 100% my opinion that these are some badass nuns. I kind of like them. They were a little saucy. I kind of like them. And I think there was a small quote also from Majjhima 19, I think. And then some encouragement to look at the role of questions in your life and also to look at the impact of language on the body. So a number of things to work with. Would anybody like to comment? How was that? Did you do it? If you, maybe you're just right now quickly reading them, that's okay too. But would anybody have a comment or a question? And how shall we do this?
I see Chris's hand up there.
Oh, okay, great. Chris.
Well, first of all, I love the fact that Mara Awesome was a man and sexist as hell. I mean, it was just like, whoa, those were little gems, such little surprises in the suttas. Thanks so much for offering that out. I had a sort of a question about Dharma lives. That was sort of introduced right at the beginning by Kim. She says, we have many Dharma lives. And I couldn't quite figure, I kept trying to figure out what Dharma lives are. So I just wanted to offer that out to the community. Anyway, that's all I had to say right now.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm Risa in Austin.
Hi, Risa.
Hi. Well, speculative views. I have my own speculative views, and I loved reading the sutta and being. I knew the view I've had is like, why? I've asked myself, why is everything cause and effect? Why isn't it just chaos? And that's speculative, because the practical teachings of the Buddha are what I follow. So, I mean, I come back to that. Thank gosh, I know better than to go down a rabbit hole. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think it's helpful to be reminded of that list, the Malunkyaputta Sutta, Majjhima 63, that it's leads to, was it disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. You know, just to kind of keep in mind, is this going that direction? And then Kim, I don't know if you want to comment on something that Chris said, or if you'd like to offer something.
Oh yeah, he said he offered it out into the community, so I wasn't sure. I think, well, first of all, we have six classes. So if you already knew the answer to that, it would be not good on Diana and my part. But we could also say that there isn't just one way that the Dharma ends up looking in somebody's life. And there can be a tendency, especially since we're sort of talking about speculative views or ideas or ideals, there's so many ways we trip ourselves up along the path by thinking that we need to be a certain way or we need to look a certain way. And of course, there's a certain amount of that in ethical conduct. We're going to talk about some of that next week, actually. But we shouldn't limit ourselves. The Dharma is about not limiting. So maybe I'll just say that for now.
Anybody else have a comment? Yes, Sam. Sam, and then Phyllis.
So I've been interested in this past week looking into affect and the affective state that comes up for me or a person I'm speaking to, and what kind of behaviors come up from like an aversion or difficult, uncomfortable affect, and specifically interested in ambivalence. So if I'm having a conversation with somebody and they're expressing or exploring their ambivalence around something, and I feel like I know which way is the better way, and I want them to go that way, and there's this like uncomfortable affective state I'm in because of their ambivalence, and yeah, I'm looking into the alternative of allowing a person to be ambivalent and allowing them to explore that ambivalence and benefit from their exploration instead of turning it into a like trying to dominate or something. But yeah, that's what I'm interested in this week.
Thank you. You're kind of born into, I think, but it's the opposite of having glommed on that this absolutely is the truth. And instead, they're not, maybe they're speculating, or they are still don't have, they're not, it's not clear. And that can be uncomfortable just as much as it can be uncomfortable when people have this kind of held dogmatic view. Kim, do you have something you'd like to add? Or?
No, that sounds very good. I mean, certainly an exercise in mindfulness to be able to just stay open like that. So that sounds like a great exploration, Sam.
And then Phyllis.
I just was wondering if I could just maybe clarify in that sutta when you just referred to the disenchantment and dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment. When I read that sutta, I had the same reaction as just when you spoke now, that dispassion to me is, I don't know if it's just pointing to equanimity, or, but to me, it just seems to almost be the opposite of what I'm hoping to find, which is more of that entire engagement into the experience.
This is great, Phyllis. You're not alone in this, with this word. Kim, do you have something you'd like to say?
Well, I could, but why don't you go ahead?
So dispassion, this word viraga, is translated a number of different ways, including like fading away. So it's more about I don't know if we have an English word, but it's more about how we kind of get tangled up with things. And like when we're in the throes of passion, then maybe we aren't seeing clearly. Instead, we're just, you know, do things unskillful. That's what's being pointed at, is it's kind of like the fading away of that entanglement that prevents us from seeing clearly. It's not about becoming cold, becoming disconnected, or becoming, flat. Instead, it's more about, yeah, maybe I'll stop there. Maybe I'll stop there. And Kim, do you have something you'd like to add? Or?
I thought that was very well described. It's maybe helpful to know that the word passion used to mean suffering. That was kind of the original meaning of the word. It's changed over time in English. And so dispassion would be letting go of that part of the experience that is tight and suffering associated, to free up the mind, to open the mind. So the actual experience of dispassion is one of opening and softening, and it's quite beautiful, actually.
And maybe I'll add, Phyllis, I liked your idea that maybe it's like equanimity. I think it's that's a nice way to think about it. It's that direction. Is it exactly the same? Honestly, I don't know. And myself, I've kind of explored this. But it's more about having some balance
I think I'm going to have to maybe look at that a little bit more for myself, because I almost feel like passion and aspiration in my mind has the same flavor. And so I guess somehow I layer this idea that passion can be skillful if it's like a positive aspiration.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. It's great to explore. And yeah, I have like lots I could say about this. Maybe I'll just say one last thing here. Maybe what you're pointing to, kind of like a passion that is tied with aspiration as skillful, might be a way in which we can think of about the word faith in this tradition. As you know, faith is one of the five faculties. It's something that we cultivate and develop as the way towards awakening. It really supports awakening. And it's not blind faith. It comes from knowledge. It comes from experience. So maybe that's something to think about or explore. Maybe one last question or comment.
Is dispassion a letting go of desire, a letting go of tanha, a letting go of thirst? Could you look at it that way?
I think that's pretty good. Yeah,
renunciation, letting go. Kim, you said that already. But I think of desire. When I think of passion, I think of wanting. And the opposite is to let go of wanting.
Yeah, with the qualification that it's the unskillful desire that we're letting go of.
Unskillful desire or desire for unskillful things? The reason I ask, I can unskillfully desire something that's actually a wholesome thing to desire, but the way I desire it is unskillful.
Yeah, we would focus on the action.
I'm sorry, Anita, yes.
Is that a difference between disenchantment and dispassion?
So there's a number of ways to think about disenchantment, and maybe Kim, you have some things to say too. One is nibbida, this word in Pali, can also be kind of, if it's like a turning away, it's kind of like a turning away. And it's also about no longer being enchanted. It's in English, we can think about no longer being under the spell of thinking, as soon as I get this object, it's going to be a source of lasting happiness. Of course, we don't think that in the front of our mind, but in the back of our minds, we often have this idea like, okay, as soon as this happens, then it'll be better somehow. And Kim, what would you like?
Yeah, I would say maybe since you pointed to the difference between disenchantment and dispassion, disenchantment is kind of the cognitive first understanding of seeing through something. You realize that it's not going to do it for you. So we're no longer enchanted with that idea, like Diana said. And then the dispassion maybe has a more emotional kind of flavor to it of fading away of that additional, that grabbing or wanting of something. I don't think they're tremendously different, but if you want a slight shade in difference, that could be it.
Thank you, Kim. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's very nice. I like that. Thank you. So shall we turn it over to you now, Kim? We'll get started on today's topic.
Okay, great. Thank you for all the great questions and comments, by the way. I always love it when people are kind of engaging. Passionately, perhaps. So I'm liking this theme that Phyllis has introduced. So I'm going to talk a little bit about relating to the suttas. And you might notice that I have a little bit of passion around this topic. So we're going to talk today about engaging with the suttas as one component of our Dharma life. And, you know, it might be that This is a new idea for some of you. For some of you, you may have been doing it already for years. Some of you may have done it for a while and decided that's not for me. And so you're thinking about, can I shut off the Zoom now? Hang on, in that I think there's going to be something for everyone today. And it's really not so much that we're focusing on the suttas, but really on kind of our relationship to them, whatever that looks like for you. It doesn't have to be any one thing. So if I have to convey just one idea today, I would say that it's that engaging with the suttas is much more than just reading. It's so much more than just reading. So let's start with translations. So a lot of us, of course, probably all of us, just read the suttas in English. But of course, they were originally written down in Pali, a totally different language. And you'll notice then that some translations are very different from other ones. And they can have really a different effect in our heart also. And so, in fact, part of what we're going to do today is look at some different translations, and you'll have a chance to practice with that later too. So Diana and I both encourage you to read multiple translations if you're engaging with the texts. Reading different translations actually brings in some of Dharma inquiry, like we talked about in the last session, because you have to kind of, you can't really settle onto a fixed idea of what the text is when the different translators are interpreting it so differently and coming up with words that have such a different impact. You're definitely going to notice that some translations are work for you better than others, quote unquote, whatever that means. What it usually means is that we like it. You know, it feels comfortable or nice to us. And, you know, we also will tend to have, I notice how very casually people will just dismiss an entire translation and say, oh, I hate that translation, or, oh, that one's bad. It's like, wow, somebody had to work on that, you know? But nonetheless, it's highlighting that we bring to our reading some kind of idea or expectation. And what is that? So that's part of our relationship, is to look at that. You know, why did I think that wasn't a great translation? So see for yourself why you're preferring. I mean, it may also be that you have some experience with a certain subject and the way, you know, from your meditation or your practice, and the way a translator says something doesn't resonate with your experience. So there's actually kind of a cognitive gap there for you, an experiential gap. So you can see, of course, our tendency is to choose the most comfortable or inspiring translation. And I think that's fine. Because part of the purpose of the text, reading the text, is to be inspired and encouraged in your practice, but just do that consciously, you know, understand that that's what you're choosing. So I just brought that in because I started with translations because it's, first of all, an important aspect, but probably we're familiar with it. But it's part of also just a larger topic that I want to go into now, which is this idea of developing a relationship with the texts. And what does that mean? It's not like a relationship with a person, is it? I'm going to suggest that it almost is, in that it goes through different phases, it goes through different stages, it changes over time, it has a lot of different dimensions to it, some of which are really great and some of which are a little frustrating. It's got all that in there. So let me just start by saying that what I value a lot about the written teachings of the Buddha is that on the one hand, they are clear and precise enough that if you follow them, if you follow the instructions, it does mature your practice and potentially lead all the way to awakening. So they're clear and precise. And yet these teachings are also flexible. They're flexible enough to accommodate many different kinds of mind. You know, the Buddha taught all kinds of people, and his teachings have stuff in them for, you know, people who are really passionate or angry, but also people who are subdued, or, you know, it's like all these different ways that we are, they can be, all can be met through the texts. So what are some different aspects of this complex and delightful relationship? We might think first, of course, of the intellectual aspect. We are reading and engaging our linguistic and intellectual mind. These are written words. So that does come in. It comes in through that channel in some sense. And so it includes thought. And for some, reading suttas provides some kind of mental pleasure. Somebody once told me that they found that reading the suttas was like scratching an itch. And I can see that. You know, I can understand that idea. But there is more. You know, it's not only this, the intellectual side. There is also a devotional or emotional side to reading the suttas. It may start out that way right away, or it may develop over time. But this means essentially having a heart connection to the words, you know, feeling that some resonance in you of what, you know, these are very human stories, some of them. I mean, some of them are really directly touching, actually, just as human encounters. And we see, you know, human foibles in the way people relate to the Buddha and their practice. So there's that. Another dimension that's relevant for me is that sometimes I feel a connection to the long line of people that have preserved these teachings over time. It was no small matter to transmit these texts, and they're, of course, not perfect renditions from over 2,000 years ago. They're not. We know that. But nonetheless, they were lovingly transmitted, written down, recited over many cultures, many people. Think about all the people that were involved in bringing these to us now. It's incredible. That is a lot of devotion to something important. So I sometimes feel that I'm part of this stream. And then in addition, there's a way the text can open a direct experience of the teaching. So this is now going beyond just normal reading, like you would read in a book or an article. These texts convey wisdom, and the channel through words is a valid one. I once read a Tibetan text, an English translation of a Tibetan verse, and I must have been in a particularly receptive state of mind because my mind fell into a state of samadhi on reading it. I was stunned. I couldn't go on reading it, and it was quite profound, actually. And so that opened me up. It's like, oh yeah, these are really pointing right at something. And I can have that experience from time to time and connecting with texts. So there is a way that they can lead to genuine direct insight. And then there's also a way that reading the texts is itself a form of protecting and preserving them, probably in ways that we don't quite realize. So I would say that there is something living in these texts. At the very least, they're a little bit of a look into the mind of whoever composed them and transmitted them over years. But maybe they even point back toward the words of the Buddha in some way, somehow. There's a little window there. I listened to an interview with Charles Hallisey, who's one of the translators of the Terigata, the poems of the awakened nuns. And he said something nice in that interview. He said, "Scripture is what happens between a person and a text. Scripture is what happens between a person and a text." So texts are a way to evoke the spiritual transformation that we're engaged in. Now, meditation is also needed, but these are an important part. So I think the suttas touch into our deepest human potential in ways that are brilliant and beautiful, and they can blow my mind at times with their profundity and ingenuity. So the good news is that they are practical and applicable to life in the West. These are not just about life in ancient India. I think that the Buddha saw so deeply into the human heart that his teachings cross space and time and culture in certain ways. That's my view. You can see for yourself, but everyone here has been touched somehow by those teachings. I think also about how these texts can provide a path if we engage with them in that way. Joseph Goldstein, some of you may know, is one of the major insight teachers here in America. And he takes the ancient practices very seriously. He reads them, still goes on retreat every year. And he, he had been practicing for about, 30 plus years when he went back to the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, you know, MN10, the most basic mindfulness meditation instructions. And everybody is almost tired of MN10 by now and think, oh, do we have to go through that again? But he did. He said, well, I'm going to go back. and he has been a teacher all this time, right? He said he found stuff in there that he had not seen before. He checked if he was actually doing all the practices. I mean, there's lots and lots of practices there, and he wasn't, and he engaged with them. And his book from a few years ago, Mindfulness, and there is the outcome of his going back and looking really carefully at the Satipatthana Sutta. I recommend it highly, as well as the 30 or 40 talks on Dharma Seed about this topic. There's a lot in there. So it's more than just reading. So let me give a couple options for how we can approach developing this relationship with the sutta and suttas, and Diana's going to talk about more. But one of them, for example, is to read a text very slowly and meditatively. You might only read one verse or even one line, and then, you know, really let it sink in to the heart. Or maybe you read and then go meditate after that. We're going to have a chance today to listen to some teachings during meditation. You can see that they land in a different way when the mind is in that meditative state. So I recommend the soaking, the slow soaking method is quite good for the suttas. And then also, in a very different vein, it's possible to take up the chanting of the suttas, because remember, these texts were meant to be spoken orally. They were recited, of course, originally, and spoken among groups of monks to help remember them and to teach each other. But also they have come over time to be chanted. And that's a good way, of course, to remember also, is to put something into a chant. Now, we don't have a big culture around chanting. And it's also a little awkward sometimes to chant by yourself. And these days you can't chant with others because Zoom is terrible for that. But nonetheless, I'll just offer that I was not expecting that on one of the retreats that I did, I suddenly got moved to chant a sutta every day for a 3-month retreat. I didn't expect that, but I wanted to, so I did it. And I started to have insights into the text after about a month. And I wasn't trying to do anything with it. It was just part of my daily practice. I was otherwise on retreat. And I started to realize, oh, this opens up a whole different dimension. It opens up an intuitive dimension, because chanting, of course, is different, very different than the intellectual engagement through our thought-based mind. Chanting goes straight into the emotional center, and that's why it's used, of course, in churches and other such institutions. So I recommend that if you're curious. There's a lot opens up through that. So that's about what I wanted to cover, what I have time to cover now, but I hope at the very least it's piqued your interest maybe in revitalizing or starting or opening up your relationship with the written text. And we'll explore that, of course, more in other ways today also. But thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you. And later today, I'll talk about how can we operationalize this. Maybe you're feeling like, yeah, wahoo, I really want to check out these texts, but I don't quite know how to do it. I'll talk specifically about how to do that a little bit later. So, and I'll give some ideas and some suggestions. But now, I'd like us to do a little bit of a kind of settle in and feel our way and experience a text. So we're going to do a guided meditation. I'll guide us in, and then I'm going to drop in different translations of just a short little verse. And you can just see what that's like. This is, one way to kind of experience the text.